From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
Democracy does not come on the back of tanks. Democracy in Syria should be established by the people of Syria. If the Bush administration wants to help the people of Syria, then they should listen to them.
Today we look at the Bush administration's targeting of Syria and Iran.
Is Iran really hiding something about its nuclear program? Or is it being ambivalent to strike a good bargain with the Europeans to surrender its right to uranium enrichment under the NPT? The jury is still out.
And we speak with famed Egyptian feminist, psychiatrist, and author Nawal al-Sadawi. She's been jailed, threatened with death. Now she plans to run for president of Egypt. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, the number of U.S. soldiers killed in the war has now reached 1,500. More than 1,300 of the U.S. troops have died after President Bush declared major combat operations over. The latest U.S. death occurred in the Babil province, south of Baghdad. Meanwhile, two car bombs have exploded near the Iraqi Interior Ministry in Baghdad, killing five people. In this country, anti-war organizers are preparing for protests in scores of cities around the United States March 19th to mark the second anniversary of the Iraq invasion. One of the largest protests is scheduled to take place outside Fort Bragg in Fayetteville, North Carolina. On Capitol Hill, Democratic Congressmember Mike Honda of California has put forward a bill that would make it easier for parents to block military recruiters from gaining access to their high school-age children. Honda wants to amend a provision of the No Child Left Behind Act that requires school districts to provide the Pentagon the names, addresses, and phone numbers of every student in the school. Honda wants to bar schools from giving out the personal information without the explicit approval of the student's parents. In other recruiting news, the Marine Corps has, for the first time in over a decade, missed its recruiting target for two consecutive months. The Marines now plan to increase the number of its recruiters by 10% and begin offering reenlistment bonuses to convince troops to stay in the Marines. Meanwhile, the publication Advertising Age is reporting the military is adjusting its marketing pitches in order to recruit more African American and Latinos into the services. The military has found the war in Iraq has especially hurt recruiting in black communities. The military has hired the Los Angeles advertising firm Muse Cordero Chen to craft TV and radio ads targeting African American communities. And the San Antonio-based firm Cartel Creativo has been hired to create Spanish language ads targeting Latino populations. National Public Radio is reporting that the Department of Homeland Security has placed electronic monitoring bracelets on the ankles of 1,700 immigrants as part of an experimental program that allows the government to track them 24 hours a day. The bracelets have been placed on a group of immigrants who have never been accused of a crime, but whose immigration status is being challenged by the government. In one case, an immigrant from Belize has been ordered to stay in his house from 6 at night to 6 in the morning. If he tries to sneak out of his Minneapolis home, his ankle bracelet sounds an alarm at a national computer center in Indiana. The experimental program is expected to last 6 more months. After that, the Department of Homeland Security will decide whether it will order all non-citizens applying to stay here to wear the electronic monitoring device. In labor news, the executive committee of the AFL-CIO has decided to double how much it spends on political efforts instead of renewing its focus on new union organizing. The decision splits two of the major union leaders in the country, AFL-CIO Chief John Sweeney and Andrew Stern of the Service Employees International Union. Stern's threatened to pull SEIU out of the AFL-CIO and launch a new workers' movement if the AFL doesn't engage in more union organizing. He criticized the AFL's decision Wednesday to increase its budget for political and legislative activity from $45 million to $90 million. Stern, along with Teamsters chief Jimmy Hoffa, unsuccessfully led an effort for the AFL to shift $35 million of union funds into new union organizing efforts. Stern said, quote, "I don't think there's a plan for organizing. I do not put much faith in elected officials of either party." Sweeney argued in favor of increasing the union's political work. He said, quote, "Unless we change the anti-worker policies that are destroying good jobs and stop the forces from the National Labor Relations Board to state governments that are rolling back workers' rights, we can't win gains for workers," he said. In news from Sudan, a senior leader of the Janjaweed militia in Sudan has claimed in a rare interview that the Sudanese government asked the militia to supply 300,000 fighters to attack civilians in Darfur. The militia leader, Musa Hilal, told Human Rights Watch in a videotaped interview in Arabic, quote, "These people get their orders from the Western Command Center and from Khartoum." Again, the militia leader saying these people get their orders from the Western Command Center and Khartoum. The Bush administration has described the mass killing of Sudanese civilians in Darfur region as a genocide, but the Sudanese government has maintained it's not behind the attacks. Musa Hilal is widely regarded as the top Janjaweed leader in Darfur, but he denies any leadership role and says his followers have not committed atrocities. However, sources at the United Nations say Hilal is on a list of 51 people suspected of heinous crimes in Darfur that should be tried at the new International Criminal Court. In other news from Africa, United Nations troops have killed at least 50 members of a militia in the northeast section of the Democratic Republic of Congo in the deadliest battle involving UN troops there in 6 years. UN spokesperson Stefan Dujarric said the UN forces came under fire first.
In the ensuing firefight, at least 50 militia members were killed and 2 UN peacekeepers were wounded. They've both since been evacuated to South Africa. At this stage, it is believed that the militia members involved in the attack did belong to the FNI. The operation resulted in the destruction of 2 militia camps, one of them believed to be battalion headquarters for the FNI militia.
Tuesday's attack targeted a militia known as the FNI, or the Nationalist and Integrationist Front. The militia is accused of assassinating 9 UN peacekeepers from Bangladesh last week in what was the worst attack on UN forces in Africa since the Rwandan genocide a decade ago. On Wednesday, the UN mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo accused the militia of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Meanwhile, in New York, the United Nations Security Council expressed its support for military action by UN troops in the Congo. Fighting between militias in the area have killed more than 50,000 since 1999 and forced 500,000 people to flee their homes. The fighting follows the country's bloody 5-year war that left nearly 4 million people dead. The UN has now a larger presence in Congo than in any other country in the world. Some 17,000 UN soldiers, police, and civilians are deployed across the Congo. Meanwhile, allegations have emerged that UN peacekeepers in Congo have repeatedly sexually abused children in the region and raped and gang-raped the people they were meant to be protecting. The UN envoy to Congo, William Lacy Swing, is expected to offer his resignation today after he meets with UN officials in New York. The United Nations is now investigating 150 allegations against 50 different UN peacekeepers working in Congo. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan.
We are taking very firm measures, changing some of the commanders, some of the civilian staff have been...
The Independent of London is also reporting that the UN's bracing for more cases of sexual abuse to surface from peacekeeping missions in other countries, including Burundi, Sierra Leone, Ivory Coast, and Haiti. And the Chicago Tribune has resumed running Aaron Magruder's comic Boondocks after it pulled the comic strip twice earlier this week because of references to President Bush's alleged drug use. Monday's strip shows a character saying, quote, "Bush got recorded admitting that he smoked weed." The comic strip's main character, Huey, replies, quote, "Maybe he smoked it to take the edge off the coke." The comic strip was written in reference to recently released audio tapes of President Bush from 1998, in which he suggested he'd once smoked marijuana and in which he said he'd never denied using cocaine.
mingi ye mwasi ngai na lingi aboya ngai na makasi akozonga mboka na boi tokutana mado yo na mobali na yo bosimba na maboko ye
ekosala ngai pasi mingi na motema mama
soki
na kanisi ndenge tobanaki ngai na yo na ndako oye oye
mado motema pasi mingi ye mwasi ngai na lingi aboya ngai na makasi nakozonga mboka na boi tokutana mado yo na mobali na yo bosima na maboko e
ekosala ngai soni mingi na motema mado soki na kanisi ndenge tozalaki ngai na yo motema mari mado e
mado motema pasi mingi ye mwasi ngai na lingi aboya ngai na makasi nakozonga mboka na boi tokutana mado yo na mobali na yo bosima na maboko
This is Democracy Now! You've been listening to music by the late Congolese musician Franco. The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Since the January elections in Iraq, the Bush administration has been touting what it calls its success in beginning the process of democratizing Iraq. And officials have said an era of sweeping change is hitting the Middle East. Supporters of the administration have celebrated the recent events in Lebanon that brought down the country's government following the assassination of the former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. And anti-government demonstrations have also taken place in Egypt for the first time in years. Meanwhile, Washington continues to amplify its rhetoric against Syria and Iran. In the coming weeks on Democracy Now!, we'll be taking a close look at the Bush administration's claim that it's bringing democracy to the region. Later in this program, we'll be joined by the famed Egyptian feminist Nawal al-Sadawi. We'll also look at recent developments in Syria with two leading Syrian human rights activists. But first, we begin with Iran. The White House has repeatedly accused Iran of trying to develop nuclear weapons and has so far refused to hold direct talks. European countries, on the other hand, have been engaged in dialogue with President Khatami's government and have stressed diplomacy. In what seemed to be a contradiction of U.S. policy, the Russian government agreed a few days ago to supply spent nuclear fuel for an Iranian nuclear reactor. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice spoke about the move in an interview on Britain's ITN News. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice talked about this throughout the process. Iran has denied that it is developing a nuclear arms program and says it is within its legal right to pursue peaceful programs for nuclear energy. We turn now to Dilip Hero. He is a veteran journalist on the Middle East. His trilogy of books on Iraq and Iran are considered some of the most definitive histories of the wars in the Persian Gulf. His forthcoming book is called Iranian Labyrinth. He joins us on the phone from Britain. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about the latest situation with Iran?
Yeah, I think two things have happened. The International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, issued a statement on Tuesday pointing out that there are certain questions which Iran has not clarified, and that's one. The second point they have made is that there's one specific military base called Parchim, And Iran has denied them access to all parts of that particular base that they had been there once before in January. They wanted to go again, and that has not happened. And then, of course, the following day, which is, of course, Wednesday, two statements were issued, one by the U.S. representative on the Board of Governors of the IAEA, Jackie Saunders, and the other statement was issued by the European Union Trioka of Britain, Germany, and France. And a summary of that, of course, has appeared in the New York Times. And, of course, the Americans have said Iran is not complying with the non-nuclear proliferation treaty, NPT, and they have broken this treaty, and they should be taken to the UN Security Council. Whereas the European statement says that whatever happened, they deeply regret that, but of course they're continuing to talk with Iran to come up with an agreement. The agreement would be basically has two parts. One is that the Iranians would give up, in quote, voluntarily, their right to enrich uranium, which is allowed under the nuclear NPT, and in return, the Europeans will help the Iranians with civilian nuclear technology and other economic concessions, like making them a most favored nation for the European Union trade and cooperation. And those talks are still going on. And, of course, there is, as you know, on the March the 25th, there is the meeting of the 35-member Board of Governors in Vienna, which, they, of course, they meet every quarter, and so Iran will be at the top of the agenda.
This is Siris Nassari, the head of the Iranian delegation to the International Atomic Energy Agency.
Nuclear fuel production is a part of a lucrative market in the very near future. Within a decade or so, there will be a much stronger demand for nuclear energy in accordance to all forecasts, and therefore a much stronger demand for nuclear fuel. We have the technology, we have the facilities, and we will produce nuclear fuel for our own consumption first, and hopefully one day for making it available in a competitive manner to others who would require it. This is a position which is supported by law, and it is also a matter of common sense. Just as no other country who has such facilities is not prepared to give up such capacity and capability, it would be entirely wrong and misguided to ask Iran to give this capability up.
Siris Nassari, the head of the Iranian delegation to the IAEA. While the Bush administration has been urging the nuclear watch group to refer Iran to the Security Council for possible sanctions, the IAEA has maintained a focus on dialogue. This is what the head of the IAEA, Mohammad Al-Baradei, had to say.
If I say there are three more important things Iran needs to do, I should say transparency, and more transparency. That's exactly where we are. We had a good meeting today with the Iranian colleagues, and again, I explained to them that it really is in their interest to make everything possible for us to speed up the process and conclude our investigation on the past program. That's part of our work, which I think also will help in the dialogue that Iran is having now with the Europeans, because the more confidence it created in with regard to their past program, the more easier the Europeans and Iran will be able to focus on the future normalization of relations in areas of economic relation, trade, technology, and securities.
Mohammad Al-Baradei, the head of the IAEA. When we come back from our break, we'll get the response from Dilip Piro, who wrote a piece in the New York Times on Wednesday called Allah and Democracy Can Get Along Fine. Then we'll be joined by the famed Egyptian feminist Nawal Sadawi. And finally, we'll speak about Syria, with Syrians. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we broadcast on over 300 radio and television stations around the country, Pacifica stations and NPR stations, public access TV and PBS stations, as well as both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, as well as DirecTV, Channel 375. And we video and audio stream at democracynow.org, closed captioning for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. I'm Amy Goodman, as we continue with De La Pira, who wrote a piece in the New York Times, Allah and Democracy Can Get Along Fine. There's a big discussion going on in the United States right now, maybe in Britain as well, De La Pira, that Bush is bringing democracy to the Middle East. Your response?
Yeah, I think actually, you know, it's, I would say, part of a spin, because, of course, we know the disaster that the Anglo-American invasion of Iraq has caused, and so they are latching on to what happened in Iraq. And the important point to remember about election in Iraq is that it, whatever happened, the credit for that goes to a gentleman, or I should say an Ayatollah, a grand Ayatollah, Ali Sistani. He is, in my view, the most powerful person in Iraq today, and I have been saying this for the past 2 years, and there's quite a lot about him in my book, Secrets and Lies. And he issued a statement calling on all believing Muslims, the believers, that voting is a religious duty, a religious duty. And that is the reason why, you know, millions of Iraqis actually, you know, went to the polling stations and voted. So in this, and of course, at the same time, we have to see that when it comes to interpretation of Islam, those militants and insurgents who were against the elections and did a lot of terrorist actions in that case were also quoting the Quran and Islam and saying that participating in this election will be un-Islamic. So whatever happened in Iraq, the, I would say, 85% of credit goes to Ayatollah Sistani. If that Sistani had not issued that statement, if there would not have been tens of thousands of posters in which you see his bearded face and his Islamic decree in Arabic, and that result would not have happened. Then, of course, we talk about the Palestinian Authority thing happened. Of course, the point about the Palestinian thing is that there was an election, first time in among for the Palestinians in January 1996. At that time, the voter turnout was 88%, and Arafat won 87% of the vote. He had opposition. This time, in the wave of democracy that Mr. Bush and Mr. Blair are drumming up, only about 65% people went to vote in Palestinian elections, and of that, only less than 60% voted for Mr. Abbas. So overall, Mr. Abbas had about 40% of the total vote. So it isn't something which has happened because of what Bush and Blair have done in Iraq, as I explained these two particular examples. And if you want more specifically, you mentioned my op-ed piece in the New York Times, were written from Doha and Qatar. I was in Doha and Qatar, where, of course, there's Al Jazeera television. There also is the forward base of the CENTCOM in Doha, you know, on the outskirts of Doha. Now, there, the Amir of Doha, Amir of Qatar, Amir Hamad Al Thani, he actually abolished censorship in 1998. So this has nothing to do with Bush and his invasion of Iraq. And in fact, he abolished the censorship because he abolished the Ministry of Information, and Al Jazeera had been there since November 1996. And whenever such stalwarts of democracy like Colin Powell, like Donald Rumsfeld, turned to Amir of Qatar and said, Mr. Amir, Mr. Hamad Al Thani, you must curb Al Jazeera. See, they are anti-American. So the man, Amir would turn around and say, excuse me, sir, I abolished censorship in my country in 1998. And here is the constitution. That constitution has 148 articles, and one of the articles specifically says, I have the actual constitution, which I've quoted in the op-ed in the New York Times on Tuesday. It says there's freedom of the press and expression in Qatar. So he said, why you are asking me, in quote, advising me, that I should curb Al Jazeera, impose censorship in a country where there is no censorship. Now, is anybody going to explain to me that this Amir did all this in 1998, March 1998 to be specific, just because of the way of democracy? As far as Lebanon is concerned, let me say something very quickly and specifically. You know, this is, again, from my dictionary of the Middle East, the essential Middle East, that in Lebanon, the implantation of democracy was done by the French. And when they had the mandate in Lebanon, they created the Republic of Lebanon, and the Constitution of Lebanon was done by the French, and they have elections in Lebanon. Since 1927, there were no elections during civil war from 75 to 1990. So it isn't that Mr. Bush and Dr. Rice came along and gave this, you know, go-ahead to democracy in Lebanon. It's been going on much longer than that. And finally, of course, Iran. Let me just, because my next book is on Iran, and I wish Dr. Rice would pick up the copy and read chapter 2 of that, which is that since the Islamic Revolution in Iran in 1979, there have been 7 parliamentary elections. There have been 8 presidential elections. There have been 2 local elections. There have been 3 elections to the Assembly of Experts. And if you add them all up, you get 20 elections in Iran over the past 24 years. And have we heard Dr. Rice or Colin Powell or Mr. Bush saying hurrah, hurrah, hurrah? And where they are doing hurrah, hurrah, hurrah is this election, so-called election in Saudi Arabia. Now, Saudi Arabia, the elections were promised in Saudi Arabia in 1962. You heard me right, 62. And so after these 42 years, elections were held, local elections, and in that election, only half of the members were elected. And even then, the Saudi citizens were so cynical about the whole thing that only 1/4 of the Saudi men, only men allowed to vote, bothered to register, and when elections came, only 2/3 of them bothered to go to the polling station. So now that particular election, if you were to read Mr. Bush's speeches, especially the one he delivered to at the American Enterprise Institute, you know, last year, that great democracy is coming in Saudi Arabia because they have held these elections, which, you know, is a bit of a joke. And I happened to be in Doha when these elections were held, and the people in Qatar were just, you know, sniggering at this. What? We had our local municipal elections in 1999, and there were women candidates, and then we had another election in 2003. There were women candidates, one of them won, and in that country of Doha, in Qatar, there is the Minister of Education, who is a woman. So is somebody telling me that it was Mr. Bush, that he is stoking the fires of democracy? And
De Lapiro, we're going to have to leave it there.
Okay.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. De Lapiro is author of The Essential Middle East, a comprehensive guide. Forthcoming book is Iranian Labyrinth. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As we turn now to Egypt, President Hosni Mubarak called on Parliament last month to change the constitution to allow opposition candidates to run for president. Under the current system, Egyptians vote for president every 6 years, choosing yes or no for a candidate approved by Parliament. Mubarak has ruled since 81, will seek a fifth six-year term in September. If Parliament approves the political reform, Mubarak will face opposition for the first time. The surprise move came amid unprecedented protests in the streets of Cairo. A coalition of political groups composed of Islamists, Nasserists, and secularists have joined forces to stage the public demonstrations opposing the renewal of Mubarak's presidential term. The coalition is named the Egyptian Movement for Change, more commonly known as the Kifaya, or Enough Movement. A few days ago, 500 protesters gathered outside Cairo University for what's being called the largest anti-Mubarak demonstration ever. Egypt was placed under emergency law for over 20 years, and public demonstrations are banned. Among the Kifaya movement's demands are modifying the constitution, opposing the succession of Gamal Mubarak, the president's son, who many say is being groomed to replace his father. They're also calling for the release of what they say are 20,000 illegal detainees from prison. Among those detainees is Ayman Nour, a leader of the new opposition party El Gad, or Tomorrow. He was arrested for allegedly forging signatures to secure a license for his party. We turn now to Nawal al-Sadawi, an internationally known feminist, human rights activist, psychologist, and writer who's planning a run for the presidency of Egypt. For decades, she has worked tirelessly on behalf of women in Egypt and the Middle East. Her novels and books on the situation of women in Egyptian and Arab society have had a deep impact on successive generations of young women. She's the founder and current leader of the Arab Women's Solidarity Association, which was closed by government decree in 1991. Her novels have stirred controversy in Egypt and around the Arab world for 30 years. She rose to prominence in 1972 with her book Women and Sex. The book dealt forthrightly with a topic that is not openly discussed in Egypt and led to her dismissal as the country's director of public health. Her magazine, which she founded in 1972 and edited, was also shut down. She has been imprisoned. The former President Sadat put her in prison, and she was not released until 1 month after his assassination. Al-Sadawi was forced into exile in the mid-1990s after state suppression of secular thinkers forced her abroad to work. She is a winner of several national and international literary prizes and has lectured around the world. Her books have been translated into 30 languages. She's currently teaching at Scripps College in Claremont, California, headed back to Egypt this weekend. We welcome you to Democracy Now!, Nawal al-Sadawi.
Welcome to you. Thank you very much.
It's very good to speak to you again. Can you talk about the announcement of Mubarak to have elections and how you decided that you will run for president?
I decided because, I live in Egypt. I come here for just one semester or half semester. So at my home in Cairo, many young people who are unemployed, you know that university graduates, men and women, there's a high rate of unemployment in Egypt. And they come to me because they know that I travel, so they tell me, can you find a job for us outside? So their only hope is to immigrate. And then I told them, if all young people immigrate and the university graduates immigrate, who will stay and fight? So they told me, so why don't we fight? And then they told me, why don't you fight? So I tell them, well, I'm writing, I'm fighting. They said, you should run and be the president of Egypt. So it was just something that I never thought about. And then we discussed it, and then I was convinced, and I am running, and I know that maybe 99% I will not win because of the Constitution, because of many other things, but still it's symbolic, and it's just breaking the taboos that ordinary people can run for the presidency, men and especially women. So that's why I did it.
Nawal Sadawi, what is your response to those who say now that President Bush is making democracy now, making democracy break out through the Middle East, elections in Iraq, in Palestine, now Mubarak announcing he will hold elections?
This is, in fact, a joke, ridiculous, and it makes me furious because they deprive us of our struggle. First of all, George Bush is not democratic. He is a global dictator. He is even a dictator here in the United States, and I have a lot of friends here in the United States who did not elect him, and in fact, democracy, even democracy in the United States is questioned because it's not democracy. What do we mean by democracy? Is democracy just to go and vote, or is it that all people from all classes can really govern themselves? So we have to understand what's democracy. George Bush cannot bring democracy to the United States, so he cannot bring it to other countries. That's number one. Number two, we cannot have democracy and freedom under foreign occupation. And we suffered under the British. I was young at that time. So now we have the American Empire. So these elections in Palestine, in Iraq, in any country, is just a joke, ridiculous. It's a big lie. If we come to Egypt, I think what Mubarak said, because of the internal pressure, we did a lot of demonstrations. Last December, I was in the streets with the people in demonstrations, and the demonstrations in the last few months were continuous, and we were collecting signatures to change the constitution. So we were fighting for years, and then they come and tell us this because Condoleezza Rice made a pressure on Mubarak, or George Bush made a pressure of Mubarak. I call this a new type of imperialist, because they do not take our resources, our oil, our material resources. They took also our efforts, our struggle for freedom. They take it and rob it of us, and they say that they are bringing us democracy and freedom. This is a big lie.
Nawal Sadawi, you're going to be returning to Egypt in a few days. What do you make of the Kifeya movement, translated as enough, this coalition of Islamists, Nasserists, secularists who are joining in these unprecedented public demonstrations opposing the renewal of Mubarak's term, also calling for the release of political prisoners?
Yes, I think this is the natural development, because we've been living now under Mubarak since 1981, since the assassination of Sadat. So this is a process that the Egyptian people, men and women, were angry, were fed up, and they wanted a change. And that's why the word kifaya means enough. Enough is enough. And in fact, the December demonstration was organized, in which I participated, was organized by the Enough group. And we have the left group, we have the Marxists, the progressive, we have the liberals, we have the even some of the capitalists, we have the Islamic progressive groups. Many, many groups are in this popular movement, and that's the new development that gives us hope, in fact, that changes will happen in Egypt. But in relation to what Mubarak said, I think we need three things. Number one, that they should do it now, because Mubarak declared a few days ago that it's a process and it will take time. because the elections will be in the autumn, in November. So if they are delayed, then it has no meaning. Then the two-thirds, because in order to be a candidate, two-thirds of the members of the parliament should approve of me or any candidate. So if the two-thirds is not omitted from the constitution, then nobody can run the elections. Because, you know, the party of the government, they own 90% of the members. The other thing, all laws in Egypt, including the emergency law, the martial law, the law of parties, the law of NGOs, should be changed so that the people in Egypt could organize from now. Because, you know, our organization was closed down illegally by the government. The law of organization inhibit people and put limitations on people to organize. So how come we have free free elections if the people cannot organize themselves?
Nawal Sadawi is our guest. Nawal, what keeps you going? I mean, you've been threatened with death a number of times. What gives you the courage to speak out in the way you have and also take on very sensitive issues like women and sex?
Well, I do not. Women are half the society. They are affected by war. They are affected by unemployment. You know, most of the young women in Egypt are unemployed, graduating from universities. So women are half the society. Anything affects the society affects women. So I do not separate whatsoever between the struggle to liberate women and the struggle to liberate our country from colonialism, from economic domination, from anything. So it's natural. You know, I am a medical doctor. Why should I speak about politics? Or I do not separate between health and politics, between poverty and politics, between the World Bank and the IMF. And the struggle for democracy. So it's all connected. And I am a novelist. Why should a novelist, you know? So I look to life as something very much connected and integrated. And I have to be in Egypt. It's my country, my family, my children, my daughter, my son, my husband. The members of our association that was banned are still there waiting so that we can bring it back if the law is changed. So this is my life. I have to fight there. And I come here just because I cannot teach in Cairo. You know, I told them I'm ready to teach in Cairo University without a salary. But they don't allow me to teach in Cairo. So I teach in Europe and in other countries.
Nawal Sadawi, the discussions going on about the release of Ayman Nour, the leader of the new opposition party, El Gad, can you tell us who he is?
In fact, I have never met him, but I heard about him that, you know, he's one of the people who are struggling. And he started his party. It's very difficult to start a party in Egypt. I wanted to do a political party. They told me women are not allowed to have a political party. So now when I go back, I will try if the law is changed to start a party. So he was very, very effective when he started his party. So he should be encouraged not to be put in prison.
Nawal Sadawi, in this Women's History Month, International Women's Day coming up, what message do you have for women not only in Egypt but here in this country?
Well, I tell them what I tell myself. Nobody is going to liberate anybody. We have to liberate ourselves. Women are going to liberate themselves. The working class are going to liberate themselves, you know. So nobody replace anybody, because some women will say, we'll wait, especially in our region, we'll wait for men to liberate us. No, we have to liberate ourselves. Our countries have to liberate ourselves. Democracy, freedom come from the inside, from the people themselves who are suffering. Women are suffering from double oppression, triple oppression. So they have to start and to have to fight for their freedom and for independence at all levels, not only the sexual, not only the cultural, the political and the economic, and at the global and local level. I like very much the word glocal, because it brings, we live in one world. I am very much against those people who say we belong to the third world. This is an insult. We live in one world, and we have to fight globally and locally.
On that note, I want to thank you very much, Nawal al-Sadawi. Have a safe trip back to Egypt. Plans are run for the presidency of her country. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Damascus. Stay with us. Marcel Khalifa here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to Syria, since September 11th and launch of the so-called War on Terror, the Bush administration has characterized the country as a supporter of terrorism and destabilizing factor in the Middle East. Since the occupation of Iraq began in March 2003, Washington's rhetoric has grown more hostile. Over the past 2 weeks, it's been overtly belligerent following the assassination of the former Lebanese Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. Syria has been accused of being behind that assassination. Large-scale demonstrations forced the Lebanese government to resign. The Bush administration has spoken of a velvet revolution sweeping the region. Many analysts believe the next front is Syria. President Bush and his emissaries are focusing in on demands for Syria to withdraw its more than 14,000 troops and intelligence services from Lebanon. This week, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice issued what many see as a series of threats against Damascus as she visited London. Here are some of what she had to say.
What is being exposed is that Syria is a barrier. Syrian policies and Syrian behavior are barriers to a better life and a more democratic future for the people of the Middle East. When the Syrians support insurgents or allow their territory to be used for insurgents, they are frustrating the aspirations of the Iraqi people. When the Syrians allow their troops and their security forces to operate in Lebanon, they are frustrating the aspirations of those Lebanese people who are in the streets in Lebanon. When the Syrians support from their territory and with their activities terrorist groups who carry out bombings in the Holy Land, they are frustrating the aspirations of the Palestinian people. So the Syrians should not be allowed to change the subject. This is not about Syria and the United States. This is Syria frustrating the aspirations of people of the Middle East for a better and more democratic life.
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice speaking earlier this week in London. President Bush also addressed Syria during a speech yesterday in Maryland.
First of all, freedom is on the march. It's a profound period of time. Our Secretary of State's returning from her trip to Europe. I will visit with her tomorrow afternoon. I talked to her on the phone yesterday. I applauded the press conference she held with a foreign minister from France, where both of them stood up and said loud and clear to Syria, you get your troops and your secret services out of Lebanon so that good democracy has a chance to flourish. The world is working together for the sake of freedom and peace. The world is speaking with one voice when it comes to making sure that democracy has a chance to flourish in Lebanon and throughout the greater Middle East. And when democracies take hold, the world becomes more peaceful. The world becomes a better place for our children, our grandchildren. So I look forward to continue to work with friends and allies to advance freedom. Not America's freedom, but universal freedom. Freedom granted by a higher being.
We now turn to a perspective seldom heard in the hours of coverage of Syria, and that is the perspective of Syrians who aren't government officials. Our two guests are both Syrian human rights activists, their father and son. Haitham Amala is one of the leading human rights attorneys in Syria. He is on the line with us from Damascus. His son, Iyas Mala, is a Syrian human rights activist based in Dallas, Texas. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's go straight to Damascus. Haitham Amala, as you listen to Condoleezza Rice and President Bush, can you respond? Haitham Amala.
I heard President Bush. Okay. Did I start?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, you can go ahead.
Go ahead. I listen to President Bush. The problem is in our country, we started in 1945 as democracy regime. But the United States Embassy created the dictatorship in our area, in our country. The first military power was created by your embassy in Damascus. It continued since 1949 till now. We are under several kinds of military dictatorship power. And now exactly, since beginning of 1963 till now, more than 42 years, we are under a case of emergency law. Under this emergency law, any law can be stopped. So we are under a heavy pressure of our government, of our regime. But in next hand, we do not trust the regime of America that they want to help us in the direction of democracy. Because we believe that America as a power, only they believe in force, they do not believe in politics. For that, they came to Iraq out of legal, out of United Nations agreement. How I can believe that the super power now in the world can be help or is going to help any country for democracy, not for their income or for their interest? We believe here in Syria that America came to Iraq and to Afghanistan not to fight against terrorists, as they said. They want to be in our area to rule the economic, the world of economic world, not to create the democracy. We are fighting, not now, since a long time, we are fighting against the regime to change our life from dictator to freedom, to democracy. But all the time passed, the regime was helped from America, from the West. So how we can believe now America, that America want to help us for changing our life to democracy? And we see now how is Gaddafi is a good man, even he still continue as military regime, as dictatorship power. We need to change our life. But if really America want to help us in this side, they can stop help the regime all the dictatorship regime in our area. This is very important. If they stop, so we can thinking about this time.
Haitham Al-Malla, I wanted to ask, you were the attorney for Maher Arar, the Syrian-Canadian citizen who was through a term
line,
we've only...
The line, repeat, not clear. The line not clear now.
Let me ask this question of Iyas Mahla, your son, human rights activist in Dallas, Texas. Iyas, your father, the attorney for Maher Arar, the Syrian-Canadian, who we've learned this term, extraordinary rendition, sent to Syria when he arrived at Kennedy Airport. You could tell the story, but also the issue of what it means for the U.S. to attack Syria over its human rights record, but then send someone to the country who is then tortured.
Exactly.
You give me the example what I need. What happened for Maher Arar is a shame. He being captured in JF Kennedy Airport in New York, and he sent to Syria, not to Canada, to be under torture for a year. And then he released without any proof, without anything. We have a new example now. The American Army catch a person. His name is Yasser Tinawi from Somalia. He has a shop there. He prepare Frigidaire and something like that with his family and his children. They catch him, take him to Ethiopia. He was under arrest 100 days for nothing. Then they take him to Cairo. They give him to the intelligence service in Egypt. And those, they send him back to Damascus. He takes 2 year sentences from field military court for nothing. He spent his time, his sentence in jail. He released for a month, from a month. Now he been under risk another time yesterday. So how I can explain this situation? They take this person from Somalia, send him back to Syria. They destroy his life. He has a job. They destroy everything, his money. Now he has no job here in Syria. How I can say it? How I can understand that America is going to help in the side of a human right? I am activist in the side of a human right, not now, since 30 years. I spent 7 years of my life in jail, beginning of 1980 till last of 1986. I continue my way when I release. Till now, I am fighting for protect my people here in Syria.
Haitham Al-Malla,
I want to be sure that the Syrian person cannot be in jail for nothing. Now,
Haitham Al-Malla, we have to wrap right now. We have to end the show. But I want to ask you in Damascus, as well as your son, Iyas Mahla, if you can rejoin us tomorrow for an extended discussion about the situation in Syria, how rarely we hear the voices of Syrian citizens talking about their own country, especially those both who have been imprisoned there. Thank you very much for joining us. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdo-Kadous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich and Jeremy Scahill, Ryan Abernathy, our engineer, our website, democracynow.org. See folks in Denver and Madison on this weekend. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.